Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
All right, good evening, everyone. A very warm welcome to all of you for coming tonight to the LSE for this public event. My name is Eric Neumeier. I'm this school's deputy president and vice chancellor. I'm very pleased to be here to welcome our speaker, Professor Susan Effie, and our audience here in the auditorium today. She will present the Stamp Memorial Lecture, which is named in honor of Josiah Charles Stamp, and it's a highly prestigious public lecture series. Susan is the Economics of Technology professor at Stanford Graduate School of Business. Susan, when was it that you won the John Bates Clark Medal?
2007.
She won one of the most prestigious prizes that one can win. It's in special recognition of outstanding contributions to economic knowledge for anyone below the age of 40. In 2022, and Susan told me in the pre-room, it was truly life-changing, which is really interesting to hear. In 2022, she took leave from Stanford to serve as chief economist at the U.S. Department of Justice Antitrust Division. Her talk today will review several recent implementations of digital technology to social impact applications, including childhood literacy, programs to enable career transitions, and to demonstrate skills and digital assistance that help workers and service providers to be more effective. For those of you who use Twitter X, I believe now, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE events. The event is being recorded, and you know, no technical difficulties. We will make it available as a podcast. Susan will speak for about 45 minutes or so, and then you'll have the opportunity to ask questions to our distinguished speaker. So let me shut up to have most time for Susan and for you later on to ask your questions. So please join me in a round of applause for our distinguished speaker.
Well, thanks so much for having me here. It's great to be here and to see everyone come out on your Wednesday night to talk about some economics and technology. So I want to talk today about some work that I've been doing with a lab that I founded at Stanford. And the lab has been working on collaborations with organizations to try to bring technology into social impact. And I'm going to talk today about the work itself and the impact it has, and I'll be interleaving throughout sort of the economic frameworks that help make this work come about. And the economics comes in multiple ways. It comes in through the theory of change and you know, setting up the lab at all and what types of work I've been working on. It comes in selecting the specific interventions that we work on. And then also, social scientists have a special role, in my view, in figuring out how to measure impact and understand what's the best way to capture in measurable terms the impact that an intervention is having. And although that might seem like that's something that cuts across all disciplines, in general, when you're intervening in people's lives or you're intervening in economies, there can be lots of unintended consequences as well as intended ones. And so thinking through having a framework for understanding all the different pathways an intervention might have can be very helpful in deciding how to measure and also in interpreting your results. So as I mentioned, I have a lab at Stanford. It's called the Golub Capital Social Impact Lab, and it's been going for 6 or 7 years now. And what we do is we partner with social sector organizations to develop and apply technology solutions for impact. And these are on this slide, it shows some of the organizations that we've collaborated with. So let me first talk a little bit about just the theory of why I set up a lab that does this. So the first big component of this work is that we co-create digital interventions together with implementing organizations. This is helpful for several reasons. The first is that there's a clear path to impact. So if you work with a provider of educational technology or an organization that trains workers, and you work together on an implementation and it works, it's very clear how to get that in front of more people because they already serve constituents and can just make the decision. So once you've convinced them to work with you on the co-creation and evaluation, they're usually completely bought in to scaling and getting the interventions in front of people. And that's a little different from if you come up with an idea in the abstract and kind of study it from arm's length, then you still afterwards, if you find something that works, have a lot of challenges getting people to adopt. You might have to convince governments or other organizations, and then there might be differences in terms of what you built and the context that the implementers are working in. Well, when you work together, you've sort of solved all those problems from the start. The second point, and this is something that I've really been a theme throughout my career, is that there's the possibility for an interdisciplinary collaboration to solve problems. So if you're working with, say, an educational technology firm, they're are going to already have people who understand the educational technology domain. That's how they built their businesses. We also, in my lab, bring in interdisciplinary scholars. So I'll recruit PhD students from the ed school or postdocs with an education and economics background that have that domain knowledge, and bring them together with engineers. I also have an appointment in an engineering organization, the ICME. It's an institute at Stanford, and also I helped found the Stanford Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence. And so I have a lot of access to computer science and engineering students, and they bring them together with our social scientists to solve problems. And those collaborations can really be magical. And it also helps you appreciate what different disciplines bring to the table. When we teach our computer science and engineering students at Stanford, when we teach them things like machine learning, we teach them methods, and they download data sets from websites and apply the methods. You might apply the same statistical method on 200 data sets in one homework assignment to see which method usually works better. Those are often prediction problems. The students don't even know what the variables in the data sets mean. They don't even know what it's about. You know, one could be about lending, another could be about education, another could be about image recognition. They're just applying methods to it, and that's, of course, very important. Those are very important skills. But then those students, when they come to real-world applications, haven't learned very much about how to think through which method is right for the application or what limitations could be. And in my private sector work, where I've served as chief economist at Microsoft and also on the boards of directors of multiple tech firms, one of the biggest challenges you see is that when you throw in engineers right out of school, they're excited about the latest technique, but they have trouble winning the confidence of business people who have to make adoption decisions. So if you train students and young scholars to work together between engineering and social sciences, you can both get the ability to build things and to know what can be built, but also the ability to make good decisions about what can be built and think about how you would measure success. And the social sciences spends a lot more time thinking about how you measure success and what the meaning of the variables are, and constructing custom measures that help understand success. So that interdisciplinary collaboration is something that I discovered myself when I went to be chief economist of Microsoft in the late 2000s. I was the only economist thrown in a sea of engineers. And I had to learn, well, what was it that I brought to the table? Like, I knew something about advertising auctions and platform economics and industry structure and mergers, but you know, how was I going to work together with engineers? And if we were collaborating on a problem, it was very interesting to learn the things that were obvious to me and not obvious to my colleagues, and vice versa. That, by the way, is how I got started in machine learning, which has been a big theme of my research for the last 15 years since. Then the last point about co-creating and really building something is another point about sort of the way we do science. There are many different ways to do science. In social sciences, it's often seen as an advantage to really keep an arm's length from your subjects. You're going to be very neutral and distant, and you know, have a theory that comes out of the textbooks and out of the research papers, and then go and sort of test it in practice. So this idea that you're going to build things and evaluate them is controversial within economics, I should say. And it's maybe not obvious to everyone what the advantages are. But some of the advantages that I see, in addition to just I like to help people and I like to do things that are beneficial for the world, but from a scientific perspective, if you build something and it works, it creates the opportunity to have a laboratory to explore why it works. So if you have an intervention that helps workers get jobs, you can tweak the intervention to try to understand, well, what is it about the intervention that helped? Is it how it motivated the workers? Is it about the information that employers got? There's lots of different hypotheses you could have about why it works, but that's easier to determine if you're starting from something that works. If I just have research that says, training programs don't usually work, it's hard to really know where to go from there. If you have a training program that didn't work, was it just a bad training program? Was it delivered badly? Was it taught badly? Was it wrong for the context? You know, I don't really know why it didn't work, and I could keep tweaking things, but I don't really have a toehold, and there could just be some fundamental flaw with the entire thing, and I'm just wasting my time when I tweak things because nothing makes a difference. It's just a bad program for some fundamental reason. Whereas if I build a program and demonstrate with high quality empirical evidence that it does work, that it does help, okay, now I know it's worthwhile to figure out why. And so I've created a laboratory where I'm going to be able to have a higher prospect of finding new insights, starting from something that I know doesn't have a fundamental flaw. And you know, we have a lot of negativity in empirical social sciences. We evaluate a lot of things that don't work, and that's very important. We don't want to keep spending money on things that don't work, but it creates a kind of a dismal science, and it's a little bit depressing. So I'm out there trying to find things that do. So the second piece, I want to give a little bit of an economic framework to why digital technology. Well, this is something I've personally always been interested in, and it's what I knew best, especially having spent a couple of years operating a search engine and a search advertising platform and helping build a cloud computing platform in the private sector. I learned a lot about technology and how you build it and what best practices were, what goes wrong and what goes right, how you evaluate it at scale, how you do innovation in Silicon Valley and beyond. But digital technology is also promising for other reasons. First of all, most digital technology has the feature that there's high fixed costs and low marginal costs. So if I build something and it's a software product, you know, it can be used for thousands or millions of people with low incremental cost. And that makes it very good if I'm trying to help the poor or help disadvantaged people, because once I built it, I don't have to worry about marginal implementation costs. Closely related to that is that a lot of technology actually can be built with a small number of people. Not everything. Building a search engine is very hard. It's very expensive. Training a large language model from scratch is also very expensive, so I can't do either of those things in my academic lab. But there are a lot of things I can build in an academic lab with, you know, 15 or 20 people, students who are turning over from year to year, postdocs who are coming. I can actually build things and get them to a point where they can be implemented. So that's an exciting thing about digital technology relative to a lot of other kinds of technology or things that involve the physical world. Third, And related to both of those is that it's a general purpose technology. Most digital technology that we're working with today, especially artificial intelligence, machine learning, these types of things, are general purpose. So in our lab, we use similar methods across training and education and digital assistance for nurses, some of the applications I'll talk about today. They're the same underlying statistical methods and the same kind of principles and designs of complex experiments can be applied across different domains. And an ed tech application that works in one country can probably be adapted or copied relatively simply for another country. So that gives us a chance as academics to really have an impact, because we can build something that is scalable and copyable. And so if we show the case studies, if we get our work out there, put the code on GitHub, write up the research paper showing the efficacy, then philanthropists can put more money in, people can build, and you can again have a much larger impact just coming from a small number of people. And this is someplace, of course, the private sector will do a lot of these things, but they're gonna focus on places where they can make money. And sometimes they'll also help people who can't pay or don't buy anything from advertisements just because it's very cheap for them to do so. But in general, there's lots of applications areas where there's not enough investment. And so by doing this research in a university setting, we can make the difference between having it get there or not, or having it come in a brief period of time. And then finally, digital technology is especially helpful especially helping low-income or disadvantaged people, because it allows us to do personalization and provide convenient access. So I can get education to people at the right place at the right time. I don't need, you know, a mother to get a babysitter to drive somewhere to get the services. She can, you know, get the training at home at the time when she has a few minutes available, or after kids have gone to bed. I can reach people in rural areas where there's not enough density of people to bring them together physically. So I can get the right information to the right people at the right time, and we can personalize it to their context, to what they need, to what they like, to what's motivating, to make sure that, you know, people who don't have access to formal education, they still are very, very busy people. They're trying to take care of their families. They're trying to put food on the table. Their time is incredibly valuable. And so even when there's free education out there, you say, well, why don't people go and get it? Well, they're not sure what's right, and they're not confident of that this information will actually be helpful to them. So getting the right information at the right place at the right time in a way that's engaging and compelling can make a big difference. So those are some of the economic theories behind the interventions and strategies that I've done. So now I'm going to go through a number of these interventions and talk about the setup and the results. All of these are things that we've evaluated empirically in the field. And again, the themes I want to highlight are that we're focusing on getting the right content or the right information to people at the right time and place. And in some of these settings, I'm going to have capacity constraints of certain types, either limits budget for subsidies or other types of capacity constraints. And so when we do try to do targeting, we also want to make sure that we get interventions to the people who value them most. But sometimes there's also equity efficiency trade-offs, and so we want to measure and pay attention to those equity efficiency trade-offs. Sometimes you can make one group better off without making the other group very much worse off and help equity. So these are things that in social sciences we're used to measuring. And then of course it's up to the decision maker how to balance those trade-offs, but at least you want to understand the differential impacts of different groups. So without further ado, let me jump into these implementations. And I realize I do not have a clock up here, so let me try to get one going. All right. So the first intervention is related to agricultural advice. And so we worked with an organization called Precision Development that's a nonprofit, and they had set up a agricultural advisory service in India. And what this service does is it provides free agricultural advice on crop cultivation, livestock, and fisheries management. And they get people to sign up for the service, and then they call them on the phone once a week with updated advice, telling people this is what's happening this week. And the information is already customized to some degree based on the type of farmer and the geographic location and so on. But one of the challenges is that when you call people, these are farmers, they're busy, they're out in the fields working, and they don't always pick up the phone to get this advice. So the problem we set up was to try to call people at the time which was most convenient for them. But of course, this might be changing, and that wasn't a piece of information that they had directly collected from the farmers when they signed up. And a challenge with the calling system is the calling system has capacity for how many calls it can place in an hour. So there are certain call times were very popular for people to pick up the phone, but they couldn't call everybody in those time slots. So what we did is we built basically a machine learning algorithm, a recommendation system that tried to look at a farmer's characteristics and their history of when they'd picked up the phone in the past weekly calls, and predict which times of day and days of the week were the most were they most likely to pick up the phone and get the advice. And so this illustration here is showing for what the data kind of looks like. For there's each farmer is a row, each time block is a column, and the shades of the colors are showing what our model predicts is how likely they are to pick up if you call them at this time. And so at the top we've visualized the number of calls allocated in each time block from the optimized algorithm, and we're going to hit those constraints, say, in the Saturday morning call times. That's a time when a lot of people are likely to pick up the phone. And so what we did after getting this data from the past is we ran a series of randomized experiments where we randomized the call times. So with half the people, we gave them a personalized algorithm, and the other half people, we called them randomly at different times. And then at the end of the week, we got the data and we updated the machine learning algorithm to improve it. And then in the following week, we did it again. Some people got purely randomized call times, other people got an updated, improved, targeted call time policy. So we had, at the end of that, we had high quality evidence about both people's underlying preferences for call times, but also the real world performance of the personalized algorithm. And prior to doing this, they didn't have any kind of targeting in terms of the call time. So these are the main results we got. First of all, we found an 8% difference, improvement in pickup time from targeting people using this algorithm. So not a huge difference, actually. We might have hoped for more, but that's what we found, is about 3 percentage points, which is an 8% over baseline improvement from the targeted policy over random call times. And so what that translated to for the organization was the potential to reach another 30,000 farmers additionally every week for the organization. A second thing we looked at is what was the difference in outcomes for male farmers and female farmers. And so the female farmers were less likely to pick up the phone than the male farmers on average. So the main algorithm was not sensitive to gender. It just targeted people and solved an optimization problem, weighting every human equally. But when we saw that the women had lower pickup times, we also did a counterfactual analysis using the randomized data and said, well, what would have happened if we had put a little bit more weight on women? And so you can trace out a possibilities curve and see how many male pickups do you lose if you want to increase the female pickups. And we see that curve is relatively flat, that frontier, and it shows that if we just decrease male pickups a little bit, we could increase female pickups a lot, because the females were liking some of these times, but they had sharper preferences for particular times, while the males were a little bit closer to indifferent between different times. So you could get a little bit more equity with a small loss in total number of calls received. So we in particular, we could improve the engagement for women 9% by reducing men's engagement by 1.7%. The last thing we noted was a challenge that often comes up and is discussed in economic evaluations, and that's called external validity. When you run an experiment, you're hoping that the results you get from your experiment will also apply in other times and places and context. In this case, we are in the same context, but we're using data from 1 week to predict what's going to happen in the next week. So we didn't think we would have a big problem with external validity. But it turned out we didn't have a huge problem, but we did have somewhat of a problem. So even though we had purely randomized data from 1 week, and how we predicted people would pick up in the next week was not as good as how they actually did pick up in the next week. Now, when we did our basic algorithm used not just the last week's data, but the last many months of data, because we want to learn how much you like different call times, and you only get one call a week. So from 1 week's data, we're not going to learn very much about you specifically and what you like. We just see one observation of whether you picked up or not. So we want to use more historical data. But when we discovered that our models were systematically under-predicting, we then looked and saw what would have happened if instead we had overweighted more recent data. And that leads to more variable predictions, because it's essentially as if you don't have as much data if you're only paying attention to recent data. But we found that indeed a farmer's right time to call shifts from week to week throughout the season. And you can think about, like, 1 week you're doing one kind of work, and as the season goes on, your work is shifting, and so your daily patterns are also shifting. And so we actually did need to pay attention to things changing over time, and the policies were in fact not stable. And so our ability to do this kind of analysis was facilitated by the fact that we did get to run multiple experiments. We had some data that was purely randomized that we could use to evaluate alternative policies that we didn't run. But also, we had a lot of data from people who were getting the personalized policy that we ran, enough to have enough precision to show that, in fact, we were under-predicting. So now let me move to the next two implementations, and both of these are in the educational context. These are working with a company called Stones to Milestones that works on helping children in India learn to read in English. And so here one of the challenges is that not everyone has English language children's books at home, so they may not have a lot of great material for kids to learn to read, especially from disadvantaged households. And sometimes the parents also don't have the skills to teach the students to learn to read English. So we did two things. The first implementation is that we built a recommendation system that showed students in this reading app stories on subjects that we predicted they would like to read based on their previous reading performance. So again, it's a little bit like Netflix for reading, where instead of just giving a curated list that everybody gets the same thing, we're giving you things that we think you'll like based on your history. And the second thing we did is we created a contest with a leaderboard that helped children develop habits. And that second implementation was designed to get a better handle on the long-term impact of using the educational app. Now, I mentioned at the beginning that one thing social scientists think a lot about is how to measure success. And so a concern with any kind of digital app is that, sure, you can get someone to click today, but it's just crowding out something else, and there's no lasting impact. Now, we still have not actually fully succeeded in evaluating, like, long-term out-of-app performance in a randomized controlled trial. That's something that's on the horizon for the future. But by creating a contest that shifted up the reading of a large group of usage of the app of a students for a large group of students, we're able to get some handle on longer-term behavior. So first, looking at the kind of Netflix recommendation system, Netflix-style recommendation system, what we're trying to do is figure out which stories to show in the app in order to get students to read and potentially keep reading. And in the baseline version of the app, before we started working with the company, their editors had just chosen a set of stories, and so every week there would be a list of stories, and any student who logged into the app would get the same stories in the same order. And so the main reason students would see different stories is just if they logged in on different days. But other than that, everybody was getting the same thing. Now, that having data like that actually makes it kind of hard to come up with a recommendation system, because in the data that you have, very few students are reading a lot of stories. And so anything that wasn't ranked very high by the editors actually wasn't, you don't have a lot of data for that. And furthermore, the people who do read the stories that are farther down the list are not your average students. These are your go-getter students. So just because the most active users of the app read a story doesn't mean that that's the story that's going to hook a kid who's just starting. So we had a problem that's, and technically that's called a lack of overlap of between the data that we had and the potential policies that we might like to implement. Nonetheless, we overcame that challenge and estimated this machine learning model, but then once we ran the experiments and actually got more stories in front of students live, that in turn creates more data that you can use in the future. Similar to what happened with the call times, where we had randomized the call times and that gave us enough data to learn counterfactually what would happen if we did something different. But here, the first implementation, we were working with not a lot of data, but we did run a randomized controlled trial between the existing app and the machine learning recommendation system. And so we found large improvements, and what I've plotted here on the y-axis of these charts is the percentage improvement in different outcomes. We have a measure of their overall usage of the app, the number of stories they read, and the reading time. And so we implemented this only in one part of the app, and those are the big orange bars. Now, we might worry that just this one part of the app gets really good, that people will do less with other parts of the app, and maybe overall they don't read any more stories. They just substitute between different parts of the app. And so we also present results here. These dark bars are showing their overall usage of the app. So what we see is that putting the recommendation system in one part of the app really increases their usage of the part of the app with the recommendations, but it also increases their overall usage of the app. So if they substitute away from other parts, they only partially substitute and they overall use the app more. And so 10% more stories overall from this recommendation system. And so we also find that it increases their over how many times they log in, and it also increases story diversity. So we show a lot more niche content, and for certain students, that makes a big difference. So we categorize students, we break them out by students who were previously consuming a lot of niche content, and those readers who liked like less popular stuff benefited more from this intervention because it made it a lot easier for them to find this niche content. And it also benefited more heavy users, those with a long history or more activity. And that's a common theme in machine learning, and it matters. And I had a last 2 years working on competition policy, not talking about that today, but something that certainly comes up in competition policy and the lawsuits against tech firms is the value of data and economies of scale. And here we're seeing that indeed, the more data, the longer data you have on people, the easier it is for you to target them and give them things that they like. So even with the same algorithm being applied to everybody, the algorithm was more effective for people for whom you had longer history of data. That also has impacts for things like privacy and the benefits to companies of retaining data for a longer period of time. Now we go to looking at the contest that we ran. And so in this contest, it was a 100-day contest. At this point, our partner, Stones to Milestones, was onboarding schools, and it was distributing the app to schools that signed up. And so we randomized schools. Some schools got the contest, and other schools didn't get the contest. They were all signing up with Stones to Milestones at the same time. The ones that got the contest were exposed to a leaderboard. And in the leaderboard, it would show how many stories you were reading relative to other students. So a very common technique used in games to try to keep people involved in games. So we taking that technique over to the educational context. And then the top 1,000 students got free books. So that was the prize. And so what we, these charts show what was happening first during the contest. The light orange bars are the treatment group and the dark bars are the control group, and the horizontal lines are showing the average. And we show that during the contest, the treated users read more stories than the control group. And actually the chart is showing the share of users that are active in a particular week, and they're also more active in the app. So they complete 80% more stories and for 50% higher engagement. We also look at heterogeneous treatment effects. So we use some of the machine learning techniques that I've developed in my methodological work to identify which groups of people benefit the most from this treatment. And we find that there's the greatest impact for younger students and poorer schools, where you can imagine that getting free books is more of a motivator if you have less books at home to start with, or a book seems more exciting to you. After the contest, this last chart shows what happens in the weeks after the contest ends. So after the contest ends, the treated schools and the control schools have the exact same experience with the app, but we see that the treated users keep reading more after the contest. Now, eventually it starts to dampen out, and at the end, 12, 13 weeks later, we can't tell the difference between the two groups, and it's too noisy anyways, but at least for the first, 4 or 5 weeks, we see strong treatment effects that persist. And so that's showing some evidence that incentivizing people to create habits can last beyond the incentive. And so that's positive news for habit formation, which is actually something that doesn't have a lot of evidence. There's some negative evidence in the educational literature on this point, especially with explicit incentives. So economists are also often get excited about explicit incentives, but the evaluations of incentivizing people to study have been shown that sometimes it's counterproductive, or at least the evidence is very mixed. So this is a positive entry into this. And one of the things that I was most excited about here is that we also see a 35% increase in difficult stories. So if people are progressing and choosing harder and harder stories that are above their grade level after the contest. So all that reading seems to also help their progression. All right, so switching to the next implementation, this is an implementation where we created a digital assistant for nurses. And this is partly based on the hypothesis that if we want AI and modern digital technology to help society, and especially help workers instead of just kick them out of jobs, we can take advantage of the opportunity to use it to complement workers and make them more productive at what they're doing. In many countries around the world, it's very difficult to find enough educated teachers, educated counselors, educated nurses in order to fill the jobs and take care of people. So in this case, we built a digital tablet assistant that would help nurses counsel patients. And we evaluated that in a hospital in Cameroon in collaboration with the doctors at the hospital and the World Bank. And we asked two questions. First, how can getting patients the right information support informed decision making? And second, how can subsidies be targeted to maximize the impact per dollar? So in this support app, this decision support app, again, the nurses are using it. The nurses are trained with the app. And it guides them through a structured interview to collect clients' needs and preferences. And so in particular, it's guiding them through the contraceptive choice decision. Everyone in the sample are women aged 15 to 49 who say at the beginning that they want to wait at least 1 year before their next pregnancy. So they want to avoid pregnancy. That's what they've chosen. And so the app guides the nurse on how to structure the method choice discussion and also how much to charge for the contraceptives. So we got funding and we give discounts and we randomized who got the discounts in order to learn who was most responsive to the discounts. From a cost-benefit perspective, these contraceptives are all much lower than the cost of an unwanted pregnancy, but there are budget constraints in terms of getting them out there. So we also want just to know how much does the cost serve as an impediment. And so we looked at two different structures for the discussion, both using the app. One is that the nurse just listed all the contraceptive methods and said, which one would you like to talk about first? In the second approach, and in both of them, the nurse had interviewed to find out what side effects you were concerned about, if you were concerned about gaining weight, if it was going to be hard for you to come back to the clinic, and so on. So it got people's preferences. In the what we call shared decision making, the app prioritizes methods based on the way that the women had answered the question. And so the app says, this is the method that seems to meet your desires the best. And so can we talk about that first? And of course, they can say they can skip it and move to the next one, but the app is basically telling them which they think is best. Then the nurse and the client discuss the methods and they choose to get one or not and go home. So the treatments in the experiment are randomizing the discounts, which translates into the cost of the contraceptive from $7 down to free for the more expensive methods, the IUD and an implant, both reversible, long-acting reversible contraceptive methods, and the recommendation method. And so both of those are randomized. So we do a lot of surveying for the customer benefits of all of this. What we find is that the app ranking leads to more discussion. So when the app is ranking them in order, the women talk about more methods. That is not obvious which way it would go. It happens to be consistent with a theory that I wrote in the QJE in 2011. Actually, that paper was written about search engines and search advertisements, but the same theory applies here. And the idea is that if it's, in this case, psychologically costlier, it takes time to gather information, you're more likely to want to gather that information the more valuable you think it is. So if you're rational and you think that it's valuable to discuss because this app has said these are good ideas for you, you're more likely to keep searching. But we didn't know how this would go, but it turned out that the app rank were more likely to discuss a larger number of methods. Then in terms of the results, first, if we look at the effect of prices, the red and the blue bars are reflecting full price for the LARC versus discounted price. For the subset of people who were randomized into the treatment where the patient just says, here's what I want to talk about, there's no app ranking, the discounts make a very big difference for the adoption of long-acting reversible contraceptives, which are much more effective in this context. The things where you have to kind of keep coming back or refilling have lower compliance, lower effectiveness. So we find that there's the discounting makes a huge difference from 11% adoption to 28% adoption based on the discounts. But when you go to the group where the app ranked the methods, the app was more likely to rank the long-acting reversible contraceptives higher because they are more effective and tended to meet people's needs better. And so those long-acting reversible contraceptives, the discounts actually didn't matter. Once they were told this is like a good method for you and they learned about those methods, they would buy them even if they cost something. Now, in a follow-up study, we actually did find that those standard errors are wide, and we actually did find that the price mattered some. So it's not that the price doesn't matter at all, but it matters less. We also find that there's greater contraceptive adoption among the people who in the app rank group, whether or not it was discounted. Then we look at personalization of the discounts, and we find that there are certain groups where you get the biggest bang for your buck in providing them discounts. So for example, young or recently pregnant clients had the biggest impact from discounts, but the optimal policy allocated some discounts to everybody. We then ran a subsequent experiment. I won't be able to give you all the details today, but it's an adaptive experiment where we basically over time learned even more how to personalize the policy as well as possible, and that helped us refine the measures of who should get a discount. The last two projects I want to briefly cover are projects that are organized around solving worker transition problems. So as digital technology comes in, we're seeing a lot of jobs maybe changing or getting workers maybe displaced, or there may be new jobs in new areas. And so we want to understand, are there ways to help people who are already past their schooling time or maybe can't afford college be able to participate in the modern economy? So we developed a feature that would simplify workers sharing credentials that they earn on Coursera on LinkedIn. And so we focused our experiment on workers from developing countries as well as those without a college degree. And one concern is that, well, Coursera offers a lot of low-cost courses, but maybe people aren't finding them from developing countries, or maybe they aren't beneficial for those people, and we're going to show that that's not true. So what we do is we created an intervention, we collaborated with Coursera, and then for all workers, after they completed a course and received a certificate, they were randomized. Some learners didn't get the intervention, and some learners did. What the intervention was, we developed a little app that in two clicks would post your certificate in a validated way onto the LinkedIn profile, so that then on the LinkedIn profile you can click on it and it takes you back to Coursera to show that it's a real certificate. And so we made that an automated process, and we nudged people to take advantage of it. What we found is that this combination of the notifications and simplification of the process improved the probability of finding a job. This was persistent over many, many months. And the treatment effect was larger for people who were transitioning into jobs that were directly related to the credential, particularly workers who didn't have experience in that area. So if you got a data science certificate and you weren't currently working in data science, posting that credential on LinkedIn had a big treatment effect on getting a job in data science. We also broke out the treatment effects according to a machine learning prediction of your baseline employability. So for people based on their characteristics, before they get the certificate, how we can predict using the LinkedIn data how likely they are to have a job in the particular fields. And we find that those with low predicted baseline employability have the highest treatment effect. People who are already well qualified for the job don't benefit much from the certificate, or at least we can't detect much benefit. The last implementation is following a similar thesis. Here we're looking in Poland. And in Poland, there's been a very effective and high growth outsourcing industry for IT. Lots of big tech companies outsourced to Poland. And then actually our program continued as after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and we started serving Ukrainian women refugees who had come to Poland as well. And in both cases, we were looking for scalable solutions to help women move into tech jobs, because there were very, very few women actually taking these jobs. And so the women in Poland were not participating in this opportunity to take part in this growing industry. And so what we did is we worked with a nonprofit, a very small nonprofit with just 4 or 5 employees in Poland, and we created 2 different programs to help women make the transition. Well, actually, I'm sorry. The first program already existed when we met the nonprofit, and that was a mentoring program. And so that mentoring program involved one-on-one meetings between mentors and mentees over 3 months. And the problem that they told us about when we met them was that it was difficult to scale. They always had hundreds of people signing up to be mentored, but they didn't have enough mentors to help the mentees. And so we did an evaluation of that program first to see how well it was working. And then we did a second program, which we created from scratch. So we worked with them, we interviewed the employers, and we said, hey, employers, what would you need to, say, get a woman with a biology degree to hire her in an IT job? What would you need? And they said, well, we'd like to see a portfolio of their work. So based on interviews with the Polish employers, we created an online course that women could take where they would have an assignment every 2 weeks, and then at the end of the program, the combination of those assignments would form a portfolio they could show to employers. We call this the Challenges Program. These 6 assignments come together into a portfolio that demonstrates relevant skills. So we released, both of these programs were oversubscribed, and so we did randomization to evaluate both of them. So for the mentoring program, each mentor picks 1,000 from 1,000 applicants and shortlists 2 applicants. So previously the mentor would just pick one and mentor them, but we asked them to pick 2, and we randomized the ones they picked. And I'm gonna show you, this is something that comes up a lot in economic context, the mentors do know who's gonna succeed. The mentors pick people who are more likely to succeed. They don't pick the people who have the highest treatment effects, they pick people who are likely to succeed. And that's probably easier for them to know because we had to do a whole study to see who benefits most, so how would they know? The challenges program was also oversubscribed. We got 600 applicants, and then we let the first 100 applicants in and then randomized the remainder to get in or not get in to the program, and then we compared treated and control. So the chart shows over the months after the programs began, the share of women with a tech job in each cohort. The green bars are the control and treatment group for the mentoring program. You can see that the mentoring control is better than the challenges, treatment and control group, showing that the mentors pick really promising applicants. But yet, there still is a treatment effect of mentoring, and that you get a large increase in the number of women who get jobs from being mentored. The challenges group, because they weren't hand-selected, has a lower baseline, and we also see a big treatment effect for the challenges group of similar absolute magnitude. Also, the challenges group increases the probability of getting a tech job. And this is a very cheap program. It only costs us about $15 a person, and it's all mostly administrative cost of like hiring someone to answer emails and debug things. So the challenges program is super cheap, while the mentoring program was capacity constrained. We look at the treatment effect heterogeneity using machine learning methods, but here I'm just showing simple subgroup analysis, and we show that mentoring is most beneficial for people who already have experience, while challenges benefits those who are entering the market. Summarizing, the digital interventions that we've developed, I believe, hold great promise. We've provided a bunch of documentation that both personalization and customization work and make a big difference in terms of the upside potential. Digital assistants can help workers be more productive, specifically in counseling, and I think there's a lot of other applications of this you can imagine where you can help someone give a more personalized and customized experience by having the teacher or counselor or nurse work with digital technology. We've showed that digital credentials can overcome some of the transition problems that we may see coming down the line as technology shifts the overall economy and where the jobs are. And all of these techniques and tools are low cost and scalable. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Well, it's very clear one couldn't charge your research with not being relevant or applicable or having impact in the world. So let's open it up for questions. Who would like to ask a question? Please raise your hand. Please wait for the mic. Please say who you are, and then please ask your question. Looking for questions, not small speeches. So yes, gentleman there with the glasses.
Hi, I'm Ramin. So the question is really out of ignorance. So my understanding is that in the classical RCT, you have one intervention, but here you can customize interventions. That's the added value of machine learning. And so the question is that in the conventional RCT, when you come up with these interventions, beforehand you have an idea why this intervention might work. But in here, the machine learning is customizing the interventions. How do we know why that customized intervention is working or not working?
Great, thank you so much for the question. So let me unpack it in a couple of different ways. Something that can be quite confusing about this kind of personalization is there can be 2 layers of an intervention. So like say with a training program, you either get the training program or you don't get the training program. or you get the mentoring or you don't get the mentoring. Then there's an algorithm, which is a mapping from your characteristics or maybe your history to get the intervention or don't get the intervention. So there's still maybe just one intervention itself, but the algorithm is a assignment policy, and that itself could be implemented as a higher level intervention. So I could first, I could take this room and, you know, randomize who gets training and who doesn't get training, or I could actually cut the room down the middle and half of you I could allocate based on your characteristics, whether you get training, and the other half I could randomly allocate it. So that second, it's like a meta experiment. And that would tell me directly whether personalization helps or not. But if I did the first thing, if I just randomized the whole room who gets the intervention and who doesn't, I can reuse that data to say counterfactually what would happen if I did targeting. Because if I think that, you know, people over 40 should get the training, well, if I randomize the room, there's going to be people in the room who are over 40 who did get the training and people over 40 who didn't get the training. So I can still evaluate what happens for people over 40, even if I didn't target people when I ran my experiment. So the benefit of testing the algorithm in practice is twofold. One is, well, if I really want to learn about my personalized policy, I'd like to see a lot of people getting the policy. So if I think men over 40 should get the training, then I want to see a lot of men over 40 getting the training. That'll help me measure the benefits more. Whereas if I randomize, then I won't have as many men over 40 getting the training. So that's one benefit. The second benefit is that sometimes the world is changing and you want to actually just see how this thing works in practice. So the fact that you did a randomized controlled trial last week doesn't necessarily guarantee that you'll get the performance you're hoping for this week. And if, say, the world is changing too fast, then, you know, it may be that if the world stayed the same, that you could get a lot of benefits from targeting. But if the world's changing too fast for you to keep up, then the targeting really might not have all the benefits it's cracked up to have. And that is a part of the reason I chose that and worked on that, was that that's a big problem in tech firms and in real world implementations. The world's changing, and so you have to put in more effort. You have to have a complicated algorithm that keeps up with changes if you want it to perform well. Okay. I'm sorry, one last bit of the answer. So you were also asking, how do I think about the mechanism? I would say that, you know, and I tried to get at this, in each of the interventions, we did have hypotheses about what would work and why. Like, we had hypotheses that the lack of the skill signaling was important, and that's why we built the whole portfolio program for the workers. In principle, now that we've shown it's work, like, if you really wanted to isolate, well, like, is it just that you get more motivated and excited about IT, or is it the skill signaling? You might be able to design another intervention that would really pull apart the pieces of the intervention. But I think the data-driven discovery is a complement, because there might be things you didn't think about, and there might be complicated interactions among the covariates. And so that's something that, and then, okay, that gives you a new hypothesis. And then, if that hypothesis should be further explored, then you run another experiment. But you don't try to anticipate everything.
Okay, who would like to ask another question? Yes, here, please.
What happens to the projects after the experiment and after the end of the year? How are they handed off or moved forward beyond that point?
And would you like to say your names, please?
Ben Dunforis.
Thanks for the question. So, one of the benefits of working with these implementing organizations is that they can just adopt them. So, like, sometimes there is more work to do from a prototype to, like, systematizing things. With the Indian EdTech company, with the recommendation system, in order to test it, we had to do the engineering to put it into practice, and so they just kept it. In the case of the challenges program in Poland, they were so excited, they've run it multiple times since then and continue accumulating things. And so the first round happened before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, after that, then they had a bunch of Ukrainian women come through, and now they're running it more often. And so afterwards, they can make it even more efficient by, like, building, you know, automating different parts of the process, so there's less emailing going on, it's less manual, but they were excited about it. Also, the evaluation that we did was very helpful for them in terms of fundraising, because once you show how something works, then of course people are more willing to invest in it. So those were success stories. One of the ones where I'm a little disappointed about is that the digital assistant for the nurses in Cameroon, we had funding to test them, but we didn't actually have continuing funding to keep them. And so the nurses really liked them, but that actually just went away after we were done. And I wasn't able to figure out how to, you know, keep that going. And I'm actually always interested in trying to find someone who wants to pick that up and go further with it. But that is a little bit more complex, because really what you'd like to do is come up with a really robust app that you could keep updating, that could serve an entire country. And since we did it, that one more as a bit of a research project, and there wasn't a countrywide IT organization providing IT for the nurses we were collaborating with, then we didn't actually take that over the finish line. And I think that does show the difference, that one was a little more of an academic, traditional academic research project. And I think that made the difference in adoption. But I still have hope that we'll find an organization that has the scale and implementation expertise to do it.
And Susan, to what extent is there, so it's one thing for the thing to keep going, but to what extent will others pick up kind of what you learn and then employ it in different countries, in different sort of context, but, you know, keeping the same sort of basic idea, i.e. is there real sort of broad impact, or is it very narrow for the particular project?
Yeah, so of course that's always harder to measure, getting back to measurement of long-term impact, but we worked with the World Bank and we socialized it pretty broadly there. And I do think, I picked the project in part because I do think this idea of digital assistance is and we did this all before ChatGPT came out, but now it's hard to argue that digital assistants aren't going to be important. So I think still having, you know, measured effectiveness, it still takes time and effort to measure the impact of things. And so I hope that encourages other people to continue down this line.
Okay. Let's have another question. Maybe we have a question from a... It's a bit gendered, the question asks. Do we have a lady like to ask a question? If not, then I'll go all the way. Yes, please, all the way in the back there in the corner. Please say your name.
Hello, my name is Alvin.
Can you speak up a little bit that we can hear you better?
Am I audible now?
Mostly.
I believe so. Okay, so my question is a bit more macro. It's about, you know how big data is increasing now as the world's changing so much. And I read this book recently, I haven't fully read it, it was called Cogs and Monsters, and it was talking about how GDP is now an outdated measure because of how much technology and services are growing. And all these definitions are changing so much. So to what extent do you believe we need new digital measures for this world, or maybe we already have them, and even if we use them more, for example, digital assistance, how would that affect the political environment of countries?
Great, so one part of the question was just how do we measure the benefits, all of these things from a macro perspective? And I think, you know, when you look at how hard it is to measure in a micro perspective, it does help inform your view of what's being missed in macro measures. So, you know, the time that the students are spending on the EdTech app, like, you know, we created a contest, we made a recommendation system, they spent more time on the app, but actually no more money changed hands. You know, maybe they sell more subscriptions in the long run, and that would get picked up in GDP. But even if, you know, nobody, even if everybody already had the app on their phone, people using it more is something that would be missed out on in any kind of productivity statistics. And then we have this micro data where we're like tracking all these students, but still we're not entirely sure that we helped them. because, you know, they might have been shifting away from some other activity. And even if I, you know, could somehow see everything they were doing on their phone, they might be shifting away from doing something offline. And then, well, is the thing they were doing offline, how valuable was that? You know, maybe they were playing imaginary games, and that would be better than reading on the phone app. Or, you know, maybe they were, you know, watching a bad TV show, and this is a better use of their time. And none of those things are really monetized, and even the people experiencing them, or the parents of the people experiencing them, will have a pretty hard time putting a value, understanding the value creation, when, especially when you take into account the substitution across different activities. So measurement's really hard. My colleague Eric Brynjolfsson at Stanford, we recently recruited him from MIT, and he has done a lot of work on trying to measure, find alternative measures of digital goods. So if you want to read more about that, Eric Brynjolfsson is the, probably the, and his co-authors have done the most recent work on that. But the, part of the answer is it is hard, and it does take additional effort to measure.
Yeah, great answer. Can we have another question, please? Yeah, again, all the way in the back, if we can get the microphone there.
Can you hear me?
Yes, please say your name.
Okay, my name's Deep. Very quickly, I'm wondering, how are you thinking about displacement of jobs? Because obviously, if this works, certain jobs will be displaced, and where do you think that type of worker will be reintegrated into the economy? So how are you seeing that, and how are you thinking about that?
Yeah, so displacement of jobs, I mean, it's obviously a huge, hugely popular topic with AI, and I don't know that I have the most precise, you know, idea of exactly how this is all going to play out. But there's a few things I like to think about. One is, I did mention I spent the last 2 years working on competition policy. And one reason I think that's so important is competition policy determines whether cost reductions by firms get passed along to consumers. If a firm is able to produce the same amount of output with fewer workers and things are competitive, then in principle, prices also go down. And so all across the economy, people pay less for their goods, and that allows the economy to improve. That allows, gives people more spending money. They spend it on other things, and it creates more jobs. So that's like the reason that, you know, we've done well with previous technological shifts, is that we've ended up reducing costs for everybody, and that's helped us grow. If you had, for example, you know, a monopolist factory owner with a single owner who couldn't find anything to spend their money on except for yachts or something, and they figured out how to make all the goods cheaply and didn't lower the prices, that can create quite a bit of problem, and I would worry about that. So that's a reason to care a lot about competition. And even though a lot of industries end up concentrated, even having a couple of competitors who are still kind of duking it out can make a pretty big difference relative to one. So protecting competition and making sure that it remains vibrant even when in sort of oligopolistic industries is important. And then in the AI space, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about now is the open source models, or the open models, the open weight models. And I've been using those in my research at Stanford. We had a conference at Stanford a couple months ago where we had people from industry talking about some of the costs and benefits of these open models. And there are certainly security concerns around them, but some of the benefits are that the whole world can build on them. And you can build on top of them and create apps, which then can be sold or given away for free if you want it, or sold for very little. We talked to a large tech company that was running their entire global customer service organization off of 4 GPUs once the open model had been fine-tuned on their customer service chat logs. So, you know, you can you can really provide a lot of service for very cheap as long as there's a competitive environment and you don't have all of that locked up and charge high prices for access. So we're going to have a lot of interesting challenges, policy challenges coming up. The security versus competition one is one nexus for that. Another nexus is like, you know, having AI models freely available versus compensating the people who created the data on which the models are trained. That's another set of trade-offs. So we've got some pretty tough policy issues coming down the line. But in my view, it's of paramount importance that we that the benefits from all of this innovation pass through to consumers and not just to rich consumers.
And Susan, in your judgment, is the tech sector in general and the AI sector in particular, is it sufficiently competitive?
Well, I mean, you just have to pick up the tech or business sections of the newspaper to understand that there's a huge challenge around chips, and there's a lot of complaints that people aired at my conference. A lot of people were complaining about access to chips and threats that might occur if a firm tried to buy chips from more than one chip maker, then you get punished and you don't get access to the chips you need. So there were all sorts of complaints of that sort floating around, and that's obviously if we have too much market power in that key input, that can raise prices for everybody and slow down the innovation. But on the model side, at this very moment, I'm seeing that you don't need a lot of open models to help put price pressure on the people who are charging. And so at this very moment, I see a lot of firms are prototyping using page services, but then as soon as they figure things out, they use open models and customize them, and those right now are providing good enough performance. So that's the way a lot of people are going today. But if the closed models get too far ahead, of course, all of that could change. So I think it's a very fragile moment. And if it's really going to be as important for everything we do, everything from national security to education to health to jobs, getting that right and avoiding like a global tax on their commerce from market power seems pretty important.
Thank you. Next question, please. Yes, please, the lady there in the middle.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Anouk. So can you comment a little bit on the, maybe also in the implementations that you presented on the inclusion of disadvantaged or low-income groups in terms of the adoption of this digital technology? For example, in some groups, some disadvantaged groups in some countries may not have mobile phones to access these technologies, or also the rapidly changing and developing devices needed for some technologies may hamper those that cannot afford it. Can you comment a little bit on that?
Yeah, so of course, it's crucial to match up the technology with the population you're serving. The smartphones are necessary for the app that we used in India, for example. And so that's going to reach certain populations, but not others. I think it's just a sort of a case-by-case basis of meeting where you are. We had a speaker come into one of my classes who was the founder of a company called Quizlet, or one of the early leaders of Quizlet, which is like a little quiz-taking app for students. And one of the things they were talking about was trade-offs they had in terms of developing better features, but then realizing that, you know, a lot of students had hand-me-down, you know, multiple years old Android devices, and they might be using them in a low bandwidth environment. And so they would test these really great features, but then decide not to roll them out because they didn't want to cut the disadvantaged population out of that. And so part of that, I think these machine learning methods that look at heterogeneous treatment effects can help you uncover things. You come in with some knowledge, but then you might not. There might be something unexpected where there's a population that's not benefiting, and then it turns out, oh, this particular population has a bandwidth issue that you hadn't realized.
next question. Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Cavi. My question specifically on digital interventions within healthcare. So I find it really interesting when leaders in tech, when they talk about the advantages of AI, one of the first things that comes that they talk about is within healthcare and kind of preventing diseases, curing diseases. But what I find really interesting is healthcare is, when you talk about tech, is fairly anachronistic. A lot of healthcare systems just don't run using fax machine. Why do you think that conventional, like non-AI digital interventions haven't been integrated into healthcare systems as they could be? And how do we kind of prevent that from replicating itself within AI?
Yeah, there's a couple of sectors where adoption can be very, very slow because the systems are like built on just legacy software that is not modern, it's not modular, and it's hard. One of the greatest things about the modern era in any company that's been born in like the last 10 years is that they were kind of born in the cloud, and they were born with the idea that everything talked to itself through APIs, and the idea that you would be replacing it, you would be replacing and updating software very quickly. But banks and medical associations and governments are on this legacy software systems that's like custom built code, and you know, everything breaks if you look at it funny. And you know, there's still like people writing COBOL code for bank core systems in Argentina, and like, you know, the banks just like put app on top of app and like kind of just add things around the outside because it's too hard nobody understands the code on the inside. So I think those are problems. And then in the United States, we have this extra problem that nobody internalizes the externalities of the bad IT systems. And in fact, there's some market power problems. And so there too, where people have just the wrong incentives basically to get modern technology. So there's a couple of sectors which are just really awful from that perspective. But then eventually, like, you just leapfrog, or you throw the whole old system away and move to a new one. And so eventually those will happen. And some banks have done that now. So I think eventually you'll get there. I think one of the things that's going to really push things is that both the doctors and the patients are just going to start using AI, and it's not going to be allowed, and they're just going to do it anyways. And you know, probably it'll be like blocked in their like work computers, but then they're going to pull out their phone and look something up because they're trying to, they want the information. And if the information is there, they're going to want to get it. So it's going to be really hard to just lock down every patient's phone and every doctor's phone for them accessing AI advice, basically. So, and then when you see that happening and you're the IT manager and you realize that like half of your people are breaking policy and probably sending confidential information out into the web and things that could get you sued, then that kind of can serve as a wake-up call to, you know, fix things and maybe get better systems. But I think it's going to be a rocky transition, and also just rocky in terms of the accuracy, because right now nobody actually has really great tools for assessing performance of these language systems. So, you know, there's just going to be a lot of trial and error and mistakes before we learn how to make them safe and reliable. But hey, they're tempting. I mean, I don't know if anyone here has tried, but like once you start talking to these chats and trying to do research that way, you know, you're sort of like, you know, it's so friendly and it kind of validates your concerns and it doesn't get annoyed if you keep asking the same question. And after a while, like, wait, why do I want to call my doctor again? But, you know, you may be getting like hallucinated information. And so, you know, ideally we would have things that are tuned and customized to give accurate information.
Yeah, I hope it doesn't hallucinate on health as much as it invents still references and stuff like this. You with the classes. Let's have a question there.
Hi. So I was wondering, it's probably a twofold question, because this all looks great, and it's absolutely interesting and fascinating how you implement all the evaluation side. But if I'm thinking about the average median, let's say, non-profit organization, especially in Europe and in these kind of developed countries, they likely lack all the assets and knowledge to implement this kind of stuff. So my question is, on one hand, on the policy side, maybe do you see any action that might help them develop this kind of capabilities? And on the other hand, from your research and your experience in evaluation, do you think there are some minimal steps that this organization might take to have some kind of evidence around their action and their impact?
That's a great question. So the donor for my lab has generally been funding researchers to help the nonprofit sector. And we had a real, in my lab, we had a real question about, like, did we want to help general nonprofits versus like a very special kind of nonprofit? For a lot of the methods that I'm talking about, you really need more, you need more customers, and you need to be able to measure the interaction with the customers. So while we worked with this company Europe, which actually Larry Katz has now got a paper going, a larger paper using linked tax data in the U.S. on this company. But you know, we've worked with some like traditional training companies, but they serve thousands of people. But in general, we've just decided to focus on the digital with people who are reaching thousands of customers. It's not to say these others aren't important, but just as you say, just like when you advise a startup company and the startup company is like, oh, I want to sell to small businesses. And I'm going to sell a product to small businesses. You'd be like, oh my gosh, do you know what you're getting into? Because if you try to sell to small businesses, like they don't pick up the phone, they don't have time to do anything. Even if you have something that hypothetically helps small businesses, like they just can't absorb it. And it's sort of like, oh, if you're going to sell to banks, well, are you ready for like a 3-year sales cycle while you go through procurement and this and that, right? So there's certain kinds of customers that are really hard to serve. And small nonprofits are a kind of customer that's very, I think, hard to serve. And I'm not sure that I would advise them to take this up. We actually have some other work that's getting presented at a conference later this week about charitable giving and charitable fundraising and using targeting on that. But I still have some mixed feelings about, like, well, do I really want to, you know, tell people this is what they should go out and do when there might be some other use of their time, like just calling a few more rich donors might make more sense than spending time, you know, targeting their mailing campaigns. So it's tricky, basically. I wish I could help everybody, but I think the kinds of interventions I'm talking about work best when you have a big enough scale that you can absorb a digital solution.
I think we have time maybe for a couple of last questions. If it's okay, we're going to take the two together. The gentleman here in the front and the woman with the necklace. Yeah. So if we can have the microphone here.
Thank you very much. You may be aware there's lots of experiments going on with assessment for replacing traditional exams in schools and other educational institutions. And some of the experiments looked very like what you were doing in Poland. Have you thought of, or do you know of any programs that are looking at replacing traditional exams with the building of portfolios, LinkedIn, and all that kind of thing that you were talking about with mentoring in Poland?
Okay. And yeah, there, that's the last question. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, for the research projects you conducted, is there any transparency about data collection and the use of AI system in any of these projects? And this question is coming from, not from the ground of ethical concerns, but the fact that knowing AI or automated system is in use might affect the impact of these systems, because people might have negative attitudes towards AI use or their personal data being collected, and whether that's part of the assessment of the digital impact they can have.
Okay, yeah, so I don't have a specific example of like evaluating portfolios for students, but I think it definitely has promise, and I'm sure there are some. In terms of the use of the data and the use of the AI. The projects I talked about today, I mean, they're using machine learning. It's not sort of language-based AI. The tablet application for the nurses was very structured, so it wasn't chatting with you. All of those, the interventions were created before ChatGPT and those things. I am working on projects now that, like, one would be helping people look at careers, different alternative career choices they can make that would use more modern AI, more recent AI developments. So, you know, in general, we have people consent for all of the experiments, although when people are signing up to use a service, they are often then signing up for have their data collected already. So when you download an app, it's going to collect your data and analyze it in order to improve the products. So those are, the consent is happening in one way or the other, either from consenting to use a service or consenting to be in an experiment if we're interacting directly with the people. I do think it'll be interesting as we start evaluating these AI interventions, that it's going to be a challenge that people's expectations and their experiences will change over time. So, like a chatbot that we released 3 years ago, people might be delighted by it and think it's really fun and be really engaged with it. And now, you know, maybe their expectations are much higher and they're a little bored with it. So the impacts of using AI could be different. On the other hand, they may be better at using it and their expectations might be better aligned with reality. So in a changing world where all of your constituents are learning about a technology, it's actually very hard to get a kind of a one snapshot and done evaluation of people's human experiences with it.
Okay, thank you very much. So let me ask you, please join me in thanking Susan for both a fascinating talk and really engaging, you know, directly and answering a lot of questions and really going out of your way to really try and answer those questions. Don't have that for every speaker. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.